Wonderful. All right. Let me flip myself to the right page. Okay. Ms. Lundborg.
Thank you.
Item 8.
Hello. Good afternoon, board, staff, members of the public. I'm Holly Lundborg, the senior environmental scientist, lead staff for your basin planning unit. I'm here today to introduce to you, the proposed water quality objectives update amendment to the water quality control plan, which is more commonly referred to as the basin plan. I'll be referring to the objective as either the water quality objective or as the proposed amendment. Both of those are going to be synonymous today. Following staff's presentation, we've scheduled time to take any comments from the board and close with any board comments or questions. And a little housekeeping is to let the interested parties know that there's an executive officer summary report and copies of this PowerPoint presentation out at the table in the lobby, and remind folks to sign a speaker card if they choose to address the board today on item 8. That's not the right button. That would be this button. Yes, okay. So today during the workshop, I'd like to present to you the goal of the basin plan amendment and present a little bit of the basin planning related history that's led us to the development of this amendment. I'd like to introduce the scope of the proposed amendment. I'll introduce the framework of the first phase of the proposed amendment and provide you a few select examples of some of the revisions that we're proposing as part of the amendment. And I will close with our tentative schedule and contact and document availability information. The goal of the basin plan amendment work is to further the development of a comprehensive region-wide groundwater protection policy. Each of our triennial reviews since at least 1988 have included groundwater-related planning issues as an item of concern. During the 2007 triennial review, all of these groundwater protection issues were included in one task, and it was at this time that staff began working on this project. In 2011, last September, the board adopted the 2011 triennial review and reaffirmed this approach and ranked or identified the development of this amendment as Task 3 of 31. This ranking reflects both staff's and the board's continuing desire to refine the groundwater protection program that's in place in the North Coast region. To achieve this, and staff is proposing a two-stepped approach. The first will be to develop a policy for inclusion in the basin plan that clearly articulates the process that the Regional Water Board uses in translating narrative water quality objectives into numeric limits in permits, orders, and other board directions. The second phase of this amendment work will be the development of the more comprehensive groundwater implementation program. I don't know what I've done, but it's not taking it now. There we go. I don't know what I did wrong. F5. Thank you, Lisa. I can't find F5.
It's at the top. It's really tiny and skinny.
Thank you. Excuse me, folks. This equipment is a little, apparently. Where am I? Okay. We've talked about that. There we are. I'm sorry, folks. Thank you, madam. This slide introduces to you the scope of the proposed basin plan amendment. As I mentioned earlier, staff is adopting a two-step approach or two-step phase for the creation of this basin plan amendment. The first phase will focus on updating Chapter 3, the water quality objectives portion of the basin plan. I will discuss this phase, this amendment, in more detail in a minute. This is the phase that we are here to discuss at the workshop today. The second phase I'm referring to as the groundwater implementation plan, basin plan amendment. And we will be pursuing that. I'll talk about the schedule for that in just a minute. Aside, just a little note about this phase, aside from the existing on-site wastewater treatment, on-site waste treatment and disposal system policy that's in the basin plan, there's very little in our implementation plan that addresses groundwater protection. And at the same time, Chapter 4, our implementation plan, has specific language that includes waste discharge prohibitions and other specific language that restricts the discharge of waste to surface waters. This results in the application of waste to land from a wide variety of domestic, industrial, and agricultural sources. Without proper control, the application of waste to land have the potential to result in the exceedance of applicable objectives, thereby causing adverse impacts to the beneficial uses of this groundwater. So, to this end, staff intends to hold a series of CEQA scoping meetings in early 2012. These meetings will be used in part to inform the public about the status of the development of this groundwater implementation program and to solicit early public comment on alternatives and associated environmental impacts that could result from the implementation of a groundwater implementation program. Staff hopes to have this draft groundwater implementation plan to you for your consideration in early 2013. There we go. I don't know which one of us did it, but together we did it. This slide presents the framework for this water quality objective update amendment, or the update amendment that we're here to discuss today. This amendment will include revisions to both chapters 3 and 4 of the basin plan and will include both editorial and substantive revisions to both chapters. The proposed editorial revisions to chapters 3 and 4 include a number of formatting type changes. One of these is the reformatting of the existing water quality objectives to present them in an alphabetical order. We are going to recommend replacing the title Section 3 Water Quality Objectives with Chapter 3, replacing Section 4 Implementation Plans with Chapter 4 Implementation Policies and Action Plans to be more inclusive of the information contained in that chapter, to introduce the section numbering system, and to remove references to the Basin Plan appendices no longer proposed for use in the Basin Plan. All of the revisions highlighted on this screen are consistent with the revisions that we've made in the editorial revisions to Chapters 1 and 2. In addition, we are recommending adding a new header to Section 4 titled Region-Wide Policies. This will be the placeholder. We're suggesting putting this right after the existing introductory language. This will be the placeholder for the policy that I'm about to discuss in more detail. It would also be the location in the basin plan that the temperature implementation policy that you discussed earlier today could be housed, as well as the aquatic ecosystems restoration policy, both of which will have regional-wide applicability, will now have a place to be housed within that chapter. We are proposing to make some slight revisions, editorial revisions, to the schedules of compliance section of Chapter 4 to be consistent with the policy that was adopted by the State Board in 2008. We're proposing to reformat and move existing tables of site-specific objectives, tables 3.1 and 3.1A, to the end of the table, at the end of the chapter, to improve readability. This is also consistent with what we've done in Chapter 2. And we've proposed creating a new table 3-1B from the footnote in table 3.1, the former footnote in table 3.1 that included the Trinity River temperature objectives. Something's not happy with me today. Is that one? That's not the one I wanted, though. This is the slide I wanted. Okay, so this top box is, we've just selected this one slide to show some of the kind of formatting changes that we're proposing to make. This important piece of information, the temperature, Trinity River temperature temperature objectives, was buried in footnote 5 of Table 3.1. It was very difficult for the uninformed or the new readers to find this information. We're recommending pulling this information out of Table 3.1, creating this new table, and putting it at the end of the table, at the end of the chapter with all the other site-specific objectives. This will also allow, our table of contents has a list of tables, and this will allow this table to then be reflected in the table of contents, increasing the reader's use and availability in finding it. We're also going to propose making a small revision to the existing temperature objective, surface water temperature objective, to include a reference to this table so that the reader who opens up the basin plan and looks at the temperature objective will know that there's other places that they can find this important information. This slide shows three bullets, three of the more substantive revisions that we're making as part of this amendment. We're proposing that the board consider a new narrative toxicity objective for groundwater. We're recommending some revisions to both the existing narrative and numeric water quality objectives for surface and groundwater to provide clarity and to update outdated language. And we're recommending the deletion of Table 3.2, titled Inorganic, Organic, and Fluoride Concentrations Not to be Exceeded in Domestic Water Supplies. This slide is the proposed groundwater toxicity objective that staff is contemplating submitting, releasing for the board's consideration. The important piece in this, one of the important pieces that I'd like to highlight in this slide is that this toxicity objective relates to not only detrimental physiological responses in humans and aquatic life, but it also clarifies the fact that the board and staff is concerned about toxicity that's caused by single substances and interactive substances. This is something that staff has felt strongly about clarifying for dischargers in the past. The second important piece of this is that we're going to be recommending that this is a new objective, but this is the first place. Let me back up. The second bullet talks about how the process that staff uses in determining whether the levels of a substance in a discharge could conceivably be toxic to beneficial uses, and it directs the reader to the new proposed policy for the application of narrative water quality objectives. I'll be talking about that in much more detail in a minute. I do want to point out that while staff feels that the adoption of a groundwater toxicity objective would provide a more efficient and sound regulatory standard, that there are, however, alternative justifications that exist that allows cleanup staff and core reg staff to write cleanup orders and provide permit levels that address toxic constituents. These alternative justifications include, in part, anti-deg, sources of drinking water, avoidance of conditions of nuisance under Water Code Section 13304, and the policies and procedures for investigations of cleanup of discharge under Water Code Section 13304. So the anti-deg was adopted in 1968. The sources of drinking water was 1988. This last policy was 1992. So you can see there's been a lot of there are outstanding policies that the staff and the board needs to consider when they're regulating discharges. But again, staff does believe that by clarifying and being transparent with what we look at when we think about toxicity from discharge, we recommend the inclusion of this toxicity objective in the basin plan amendment. I've selected this example. This slide is an example of some of the revisions that we're going to be making in this proposed amendment. I've selected the surface water chemical constituent objective because I think it raises a couple of points. First, I'd like to point out that we are required under law to protect all beneficial uses of water, not just domestic, agricultural, and municipal supplies. So to clarify this, staff is recommending that we strike the language designated as municipal, domestic, and agricultural supplies from the language. I'd also like to point out that the vast range of constituents that are covered by this objective can adversely affect aquatic life-based beneficial uses at levels that are much lower than drinking water standards, and this leads to a level of unnecessary confusion from the regulatory community's perspective. So in addition to that change, staff is recommending that the reference to Table 3.2 and Title 22 be struck from the language and replaced with a citation directing the reader to the narrative water quality policy under development. This next slide that I'm going to be presenting will illustrate some of the controversy, confusion, and animosity that arises when stakeholders try to use the outdated and incomplete information contained in our Table 3.2. There are a couple of things I'd like to make with this slide. First of all, just for the record, I'd like to point out to you that I've converted the values for the basin planning Table 3.2 from milligrams per liter to micrograms per liter, just for comparison's sakes. So this is just for presentation. And then I'd like to give you a little bit of background about Table 3.2 before I start in on the nuts and bolts of this slide. The constituents and values that are contained in Table 3.2 were first presented in the mid-1970s and were derived from the maximum contaminant levels that were in place in Title 22 of the California Code of Regulation at that time. Despite subsequent revisions to the constituents and values in our Table 3.2, in the intervening years, many of these values presented in the table are no longer appropriate to protect either domestic water supplies or agriculture or aquatic beneficial uses of water. In fact, some of these constituents on the table are no longer in use, and many, many others that are not listed are present in discharge in the North Coast region. Just to help put this in the larger context, Table 3.2, which I have an example of here for you. Table 3.2, thank you, has 51 constituents on it. 10 inorganic chemicals, while there are 15 inorganic chemicals contained on the CTR, the California Toxic Rule State Implementation Plan list. Conversely, there are 40, let me make sure I get my numbers correct here. There are 61 organic chemical constituents contained on the title on the CTR at SIP list, but yet only 40 of them are contained on our title, on our Table 3.2. This is a cheat sheet that some of your staff has generated. The yellow are the constituents that are included in our Table 3.2. Yet this is a partial list of the constituents that staff goes through a best professional judgment exercise in determining whether they're going to be impacts from. So you can see if the discharger in good conscience goes to our Table 3.2 to see what kinds of constituents of concern we have in front of us, they're going to be significantly misled. We think this is not doing a service to our constituents. If we were to try to ensure that the values contained in our Table 3.2 and the constituents contained in Table 3.2 were consistent with Title 22 or the CTR, it would require a vast amount of basin planning resources, which we frankly just do not have. Based on our past experience, staff believes that the list of Table 22, in fact, and CTR values will continue to expand as new chemicals are approved for use and as new science helps inform new protective limits. The title of this table also adds a great deal of confusion. The title, inorganic, organic, fluoride concentrations not to be exceeded in municipal and domestic supplies. However, a number of the constituents that are covered by these, a number of these constituents that are covered by this narrative or this block of narratives are, in fact, aquatic life is very sensitive to them. So again, if folks think that, oh, arsenic, my arsenic values are based on basin plan table 50, okay. CTR, the drinking water value is 50. Oh, okay, that's good. What are the CTR values? Well, as you can see from this example, they range from 340 micrograms per liter for acute toxicity for freshwater aquatics to 150. So in this case, our basin plan is pretty accurate. Folks will be able to make a determination that their discharge when they come to request a permit from you is going to be in compliance. Let's look at an example for cadmium, however. The basin plan has a requirement for 10 micrograms per liter. The drinking water standard is half what we have, which is 5. So if you only have drinking water supplies, you'd be generating a permit that had an effluent limit or a cleanup order of 5. But yet, if you do your thorough evaluation, you're going to see that the CTR values range from 2.83 to 1.8 for aquatic freshwater protection. So the point that I'm trying to make here is that by looking at this table, the fact that we have this table in our basin plan has led to hours and hours of unnecessary conflict and staff time that, frankly, doesn't need to be there if we had a clearer and more transparent process in place. Let me just point out that not only is the title of Table 3.2 confusing, directing folks to think about that only applies to domestic and municipal drinking water supplies, there is the infamous footnote 2 to Table 3.2, which states in part that more stringent objectives may be applied. This has led to many disagreements as both staff tries to articulate and dischargers try to understand what is meant by more stringent objectives. Every time staff develops a numeric limit for a consideration in a permit order or board direction, they engage in some sort of multi-stepped analysis based on their professional judgment. An example of such a judgment could be: staff begin their review with the identification of the suite of beneficial uses that could be present in the receiving water. In the case of the example that I have in front of us, we're going to assume that the discharge is going to potentially could affect drinking water supplies and aquatic life. Staff then figures out the constituents of concern in the discharge. The examples that I've used in this case are arsenic, cadmium, and mercury, and are just used for representative purposes. The third step staff generally takes is to ID the applicable source of source of the criteria, such as I have listed here, the basin plan table 3.2, CTR, CCR, Title 22, MCLs, CTR, SIP standards, WHO standards, OEHA, public health goals, whatever the most protective value is for the beneficial uses that they've identified. Staff pulls that information together. After they've done that, staff then selects the value that is the most protective of the most sensitive beneficial uses, be it coho salmon, freshwater shrimp, or water supplies. Finally, staff then considers all the other policies that I've just discussed, such as anti-DEG, to ensure that they're compliant, that the discharge will be compliant with state and federal law. So this is this basic process that I've just outlined is the process that staff has attempted to capture in the proposed narrative water quality objective. Staff believes that the removal of the guesswork, at least from the discharger's perspective, associated with the establishment of numeric limits, will provide clarity, transparency in the regulatory process staff uses when adopting permits, orders, and other board directives. So this is, in a nutshell, what the proposed policy for the application of water quality objectives would look like. As I have just presented, staff has long identified the need to replace the poorly formatted and outdated information and inappropriately titled Table 3.2 with this new narrative water quality objective. The policy will clearly articulate that the focus of the Regional Water Board's effort is to protect all beneficial uses and is not restricted to the protection of drinking water related maximum contaminant levels. The proposed policy will identify steps staff uses to establish relevant numeric values that may be more appropriate than those presented in Table 3.2 to protect the most sensitive beneficial uses of the affected groundwater or surface water body. Other regional boards have adopted similar policies into their basin plan that provide clarity, that clarify the method they use in selecting these applicable numeric values when translating narrative water quality objectives. Staff has incorporated many elements from the Central Valley Regional Water Board and the San Francisco Regional Water Board's policies. So that's, in a nutshell, what it is staff has been working on over the last year and a half or so. This slide presents our schedule, our tentative schedule for what we envision happening in the near future. As you can see, we're proposing to hold a workshop. We have a workshop, in fact, scheduled in Weaverville on November 8th to do some outreach to the folks in the northern part of our region. We propose to have the staff report and the proposed basin plan amendment language itself ready for public release in early November. We will hold the comment period open for probably 30 days until about mid-December so that we can bring those comments back together. And what we propose at that time then is to have another workshop in January where you'll have the document in front of us. You'll have the first round of public comments, our response to them. We would then recommend that we extend comment out a little bit longer, close it in enough time that we can bring to you a full and complete package for your consideration in March of 2012. One of the things that I forgot to say earlier, and I really meant to, was that I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Lauren Clyde, who is your basin planning staff lead developer in this project, who's not able to be here today to give her own pitch. But I'd like to thank her for all her efforts that she has exhibited in keeping this amendment moving and going forward in a fairly brisk fashion. So thank you, Lauren. This final list provides our contact information. I recommend folks to please sign up on the Basin Planning Lyris list. I check it periodically. We have a fair amount of sign-ups, but I will say that it's mostly board members and staff, so I'd like to encourage the public to get on the list as well. We have a website. The link is here. Basin Planning staff is pretty good about making sure that they're updating their web pages. And here's Lauren's contact information, her email address, and her phone number if you have any specific questions. With that, I will conclude my presentation. Be more than willing to take questions or turn it over to the public, whatever your choice is.
Thank you, Holly. No, that was great, and we appreciate the update on that. You've been making a lot of progress on it, and the examples of the editorial changes and some of the clarifications, they look very, you know, like they're just common sense type changes with cleaning up some of the tables and things. And you've certainly had to live through that with going through the cross-referencing and having to explain that to folks on what it is. So it looks like it's all moving forward great. So just look forward to seeing the next steps.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Please.
Holly, can you walk me through, say, like a underground tank site that released a bunch of, gasoline contaminants into groundwater? Where in the past, and I admit I work in this world and have been, there's a common, I would say, gripe out there that, like if you look at ESLs in Region 2, they're pretty comprehensive. If you look at Marshak's stuff, it lists all those criteria and kind of pieces and parts. PRGs from Region 9, a lot of those are in there. You don't find the aggregates like, say, TPH, which is a catch-all, total petroleum hydrocarbons. With our table 3.2, and I don't have 3.2 in front of me, but I believe it mainly the constituents that were covered by Title 22, like benzene, MTBE, which has a secondary and primary MCL. But it didn't have, you know, a lot of the other chemicals in there, especially some of the fuel oxygenates and that type of stuff. So even though 3.2 was incomplete, how then, if 3.2 goes away and is then replaced by a narrative, then how would one find cleanup objectives that we could, because the common request is that I hear is, what is the, where is it? Where do I got to get this thing cleaned up to? And where's the line, right? So how would that work here? How would, because what people want is oftentimes is definitives, right? They want to know where that line is.
And that's the intent with the policy, is to make it, is to articulate to stakeholders and the public that it's not a cookbook approach, that it's a stepwise process, that there's thoughts, there's a thought process that has to be gone through, starting with what are the beneficial uses, then what are the constituents that could affect the beneficial, what it can affect the beneficial use, what is the suite of constituents, the toxicity issue, the multi, you know, the synchronicity sort of thing. So it's really difficult to say, well, if you have, I guess it would be fairly straightforward if it was just benzene to say, well, okay, drinking water standards, MCL is
one part per billion.
Is this. Yeah. And if for some reason it's going to get out into the aquatics, you know, if it's going to leak, it's going to base flow into a creek, then the standard would be this. That's easy enough to do. Where it gets more difficult is when you have interactions between constituents, then it's not just necessarily a straightforward number. So all I guess this, there, it's not going to be as easy. Well, I brought it in, and do I have it with me? I brought in Marshak's document, and I was going to kind of hold that up too, but I left it over there because it's, as you know from working through it, you don't just flip to a page. You don't just say aluminum. Here it is.
Right.
Unfortunately, that's how it is. That and Marshak's document, Marshak's approach, what Region 5 has done, what Region 2 has done, and what we're building upon. All it's going to do is, frankly, articulate the process that we go through so that if staff, if we get to a snag, we can say, okay, well, we're agreeing on step one. We agree that these are the suite of beneficial uses. We get down to step, we agree that step two, we agree that these are the constituents in the discharge. Where we hit the snag is on step four. So then you can at least narrow your range of where we're not quite understanding where we're falling apart and understanding why I'm recommending X for this discharge, and the discharger thinks that when he reviews the literature, it should be X minus one.
Well, and it's quite interesting because, again, if you take, say, the underground tank, the leaking underground tank situation, and I assume in Region 1 anyway, most all groundwater, except maybe towards the coast, is drinking water. It has a beneficial use of drinking water. Municipal and domestic supply, which is a fairly stringent beneficial use criteria from the standpoint of water quality, right? Those MCLs then become probably your backstop and one of the major backstops to go look at. Mm-hmm. The one thing that I've seen is because there is not those lookup tables like, say, the ESL tables, environmental screening levels, that Region 2 uses that are based at least some part on risk, is that the community out there that's trying to find that bright line of where that closure level or cleanup level is trying to figure that out constantly. And so if you look at the great body of work that consultants have put out in trying to do cleanup sites, you know, they use anything and everything, including Region 2's cleanup levels, and try to use them in here, right, in our region. They use Region 9 stuff. They use basically anything you could get because, again, the kind of gripe out there is, well, I don't know where it is. I can't find it in a table. It's not published. And again, the criticism has been it can be subjective, right? Because if you look at Marshak, which I'm, you know, we talk about, Marshak is a great body of work that has taken for many constituents and found all those levels that apply, and they're not one level. They're all over the place, and it's quite interesting. I agree. The first couple steps of that process that I see you articulating are fairly straight ahead. You know, your beneficial use is typically a pretty high standard for groundwater anyway, and I'm talking in this example about groundwater. So a leaking tank, it's subsurface, it leaks to groundwater. That has a beneficial use of drinking water. So that's a fairly high level of water quality that you got to aim at. But what gets progressively harder then is to then come to some type of, as you go and drill towards and drill down into that process, is find where that endpoint is, that numeric endpoint sometimes. And I'm sure it's hard for staff. I know it is, because I've talked to some staff about it over the years about what is the cleanup level here? Because oftentimes it's become non-detect, right? Our basin plan has at least the language in it that, and actually showed us some of the state board level of a background or non-detect. And so when it comes to it, that becomes that, and those are, you know, you look at benzene's a half a part per billion on detection limit on a standard 8260 run, and that's kind of true out there. And it's, I like the road you're going down, but it's still, you know, and I the endpoints, those, as you drill deeper in there, it does become harder from the end user community out there, and probably for staff, I got to imagine, too, to try and go, where is this endpoint? What are we going to apply here?
Well, and it's not up right now. I don't know how to make it get back up there, but bullets. That was funny. Well, bullets.
You actually did pretty good, Holly. You got it all the way through here.
There we go. Bullet six, and I think this is where the catch-all is. Bullet six, yeah. And then anti-deg.
Yes, and anti-deg is very interesting because, you know, I've had many times where, you know, if you look at, say, like, well, in most cases, benzene is not a naturally occurring compound. So you get benzene in that groundwater system. It has a MCL one part per billion or microgram per liter by Title 22, but yet you look at anti-deg, and it's not supposed to be there at all, really. And so it's quite interesting. I'm not so sure myself that it makes it easier in a narrative sense, but 3.2 wasn't easy anyway. And I like the way you're going. I just am kind of thinking about it from the standpoint of what I've seen over the years in trying to come to, especially when you're doing something like a cleanup or, say, a landfill or even surface water impacts out there, whether it be bacterial or anything else, constituents, that I think it's a dilemma for staff. I think it's a dilemma for the outside end users as well. So I like the way you're going. I'm interested in the kind of those lower levels and how we resolve that as we go. I would imagine that this leads, and then some of the rest of this perhaps even follows, and we, out of then a narrative, could become an articulated body of work out there that could then better define some of these things based either on beneficial use criteria, time, space, whatever it is that we're trying to get at to be truly protective of water quality. So I appreciate your efforts. I truly do. It's not easy. And I think globally in the greater regulatory world of California as a whole, it's kind of scrambled eggs, because it's, what does it apply? Where are you at? Because it changes. It changes whether you're in Region 2, Region 1, Region 5, and what you're talking about. And it's, you know, there's been a fair amount of criticism out there over the years and currently, too, about, you know, some of this stuff. It changes. We're not consistent as an agency from the state board or regional boards about what our limits are. And, in fact, that's some of the movement that has come about in the underground tank world recently, is to try and set some statewide policy about what is a low-risk site. Now, you know, how that goes and how that ends up in the end, I'm not so sure. But in our region, this narrative, I think, is helpful. What is going to be the interesting part to me is how we carry that through in the application of the real world out there for both our staff and the regulated community.
Okay.
So, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Holly. Any cards?
Trust me to touch them again.
No cards. Okay.
Emailed it.
All right. Let's Move on to item number 9.